This is the State of Things from the Upstage Cabaret at Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stacio. Thank you. And we awoke to news this morning of one of the biggest mergers in Triad history. Tobacco giants Reynolds American and Lorillard announced a $27 billion deal that also involves two British-based tobacco companies. It's a complicated package. It is structured apparently to avoid antitrust objections, and it has important economic implications for the Triad and the state of North Carolina. Joining us now is Richard Craver of the Winston-Salem Journal. Richard, welcome. Good to have you here as well.
Thank you for having me.
So four corporations involved in this deal. Give us a sense of what's going on here.
Well, if you want to boil it down to its essence, essentially what Reynolds has done, and I'm trying to get confirmation to make sure the numbers are correct, essentially what Reynolds has done is they've bought Newport. Essentially everything else that belongs to Lorillard at this point will go to Imperial Tobacco. The Blue E-Cigs, the other brands that they have besides Newport, the manufacturing plant, the 2,900 employees. So if you think about it from that perspective, that was probably the best-case scenario the Tri could have rather than Reynolds doing a traditional deal for Lorillard and probably hundreds of jobs would have gone away in the consolidation.
So let's break that down again. If Reynolds had bought Lorillard in a straight-up deal, it's likely that the manufacturing plant that Lorillard has here in Greensboro would have gone.
Eventually. I think what would have happened was is that there would have been enough production of the brands that between Camel and Pall Mall and Newport and with Reynolds committing to the Vuse product in Tobaccoville, that there probably would have been enough production in short term to keep both plants going. But eventually, in order to get the cost savings they say they want from this deal, which is close to $1 billion, they would have to have closed one of the plants.
But it's more likely now that Greensboro plant stays open because now there's a third party involved. Imperial, is that it? Or that's the
right.
Parent corporation?
Right. Imperial's the parent corporation. But essentially what they did was about a couple weeks ago, they made it public that they were doing an initial public offering of a Spanish subsidiary. And by them doing that, it freed up, or at least they hope they will free up enough money to be able to buy these non-growth brands, Reynolds and Lorillard. And essentially a non-growth brand is anything that neither one of them particularly market now. So by them doing that, Imperial had already had a presence in Reidsville with Commonwealth Brands, and I'm actually trying to get an answer if the Lorillard name will actually survive this merger because they may decide to go with Commonwealth Brands because that's their brand.
And their share of the market, I mean, this is a good deal, and maybe one of the reasons they would keep the plant open in Greensboro, and again, we're talking about 2,900 jobs, right, or so. One of the reasons they might keep it open is their market share will really go up in this deal, right?
Well, right now we estimate their market share in the United States is probably 3 to 3.5%. And to put that into perspective, you look at Winston, which is a non-growth brand that Reynolds has now, it has about 2.2% by itself, and it's not really marketed at all. So from that perspective, they would probably need the extra production. Now, whether they bring the Blue E-Cig production in-house or they continue to have it, the cartridges made in China and the liquid made in Charlotte, I guess that's one of the things we'll have to wait and see. But essentially, I imagine their production is going to be larger than the Reidsville plant would probably be able to handle. We're still trying to get estimates. I think they have somewhere around 1,100 production jobs. So that's really the ones that we're talking about being saved, as well as, you know, eliminating most of the overlap with sales and marketing and administrative and the like.
And am I right to think that there's going to be an expansion of more jobs created in a Reynolds e-cigarette production?
Right. They've already made a commitment of, you know, a few weeks ago to add 200 jobs as part of doing bringing more in-house the Vuse product. They had already been making the product in Kansas, and now they're going to complement what they do in Kansas in Winston-Salem, and who knows, they may end up pulling it all into Winston-Salem at some point. So you have that, and then Reynolds kind of hinted today that they may end up having even more production jobs because eventually, in the short term, if this deal goes through, Imperial is going to contract out and do Newport for Reynolds, and then Reynolds is going to do Winston and Salem and Cool for Imperial, and eventually they'll switch. And just by the nature of the production level of more Newport than those other three brands, eventually they're going to have more production in Tobaccoville, so it's likely they would add jobs to handle that production.
Kind of interesting because at least at the moment it looks like a merger is going to actually create more jobs for an area than would be lost. Ordinarily it's the other way around, isn't it?
Well, like I said, we have to see. You know, this is more – when it comes to consolidation, even though there may be some consolidated jobs with Reynolds because, you know, you probably have people who are Newport salesmen only. And now, will they try to merge those in with the Camel Pall Mall sales? You know, you have the people out in the field to go to the convenience stores and the like. But it may be more of an issue with Commonwealth and Lorillard in terms of administrative and back office and things like that.
So what the other question is, Reynolds, if I'm right, is the largest. Lorillard is their biggest competitor. These are two big firms. Is it legal? Will this pass muster?
Well, as of this time, Philip Morris USA, which is the makes Marlboro, has about 50.7% of the U.S. market share. Reynolds has about 26.7%, if I remember correctly. Lorillard has right about 15%. So you're talking about, if they just did a straight deal, they would own 92%. The two companies together would own 92% of the market share. By them doing that, it's pretty unlikely the FTC would go along with that. So what was interesting about today's announcement, it was the Blue E-Cigs part of it, because Reynolds agreed to let Imperial take that, and then to a degree British American Tobacco allowed them to take that, consider their competitors. So from that perspective, it may have been sort of a preemptive aspect to say, listen, we're trying to consolidate and kind of assure yourselves that we're not going to have a duopoly. This is one of the ways.
All right. Well, we will keep track. Richard Carver, thank you so much. A reporter for the Winston-Salem Journal. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, there's more news in the triad today. The GOP primary runoff election underway today here in the 6th Congressional District. Voters deciding between Phil Berger Jr. and Mark Walker. It's turned bitter and personal despite, or maybe because of, the fact that little separates the two candidates politically. Susan Ladd is here from the Greensboro News and Record. Hello, Susan.
Thank you for having me.
Phil Berger Jr., Mark Walker's campaigns have been called divisive. State representative used the word cowardly in this fight. It's gotten kind of nasty, huh?
It has, and a lot of the reason for that is a huge involvement of PAC money. Super PAC, Keep Conservatives United, has spent close to $200,000 since the beginning of this race largely on Phil Berger's behalf, either attacking candidates that opposed him or supporting Berger. And it's just gotten worse.
We like to think of these races these days in terms of the traditional party and the Tea Party. It doesn't really cut that way in this race, does it?
It doesn't. It's a very it goes against that grain completely. There are people from the traditional Republican side that are going for either candidate. Same with the Tea Party, with the sort of Tea Party followers. It is not breaking along those lines at all, and there is a lot of passion on both sides of the followers.
Passion on both sides, a lot of rhetoric on both sides, and yet when you examine the record and when you examine what each of these candidates have to say, as you've done, you sat down with both of them, not much separates them.
No. They couldn't, if they were any more far right, they'd fall off the edge. You know, they're extremely conservative Republican candidates. There are just a few little differences. Walker supports term limits, whereas Berger, not so much, unless the voters call for it. But otherwise, they essentially have very similar positions. When this primary started, it was who can be the most conservative, and you had 9 GOP candidates in the first primary, and so I think that they're very different people. They're very different personalities.
Well, let's talk about that and how that has played into this and some of the debates over Facebook posts, et cetera.
Right. Phil Berger is he has a lot of money and influence behind him. He's very polished. He's a district attorney. He knows how to speak. He knows how to make an argument. Mark Walker is a preacher, and he too has oratorical skills, but he is just more down to earth. He's not quite so polished, and he really wants to get into detail when he talks about the issues, which can sometimes work against him when some people are more comfortable with the quicker sound bites.
Quicker sound bites. We like that in this business. No, we spend some time with you. And who's the most Greensboro-ish? There's a big deal here.
Well, Phil Berger is a Rockingham County guy. Phil Berger Jr. Mark Walker has been in this. He's not from this area originally, but he's been here since the 1991, maybe. Has a lot of people in working on his campaign are from his background as a pastor at Lawndale Baptist Church. which is, I think, a mega church. It's a very large church. And within the faith community, he has a whole lot of followers there.
Big flap over his Facebook post. Who posted it, and whether or not he did go to UNCG?
Oh, it's honestly, it's kind of silly. I think if they really wanted people to think he was from UNCG, he would have been putting that on all his materials, and that is the only place it ever showed up. The amnesty thing is a little silly, too, quite honestly.
So in this case, it was that the folks in the Berger campaign, or the Walker campaign, said that Berger hacked the Facebook page, put it on there, then came back and said it was a lie.
Right. I mean, it's really gotten to this race has turned all the way up to the red zone at this point. Anything is fodder. Because it's just gotten so divisive. And Berger called Walker a deranged, unhinged, pathological liar. Berger's campaign sent that tweet out after Walker misspoke he accused Phil Berger in the debate of having been censured for ethics violations, which turned out not to be true. And as a result, the Berger campaign labeled him a deranged, unhinged, pathological liar.
Wow.
And these are two Republicans.
Well, I was going to say, and after today, they'll be picking on Democrats, at least one of them, right?
Well, I actually had a prominent Republican here in Greensboro tell me at the polls today that if Phil Berger wins, he is going to vote for a Democrat in the fall. And that's a powerful statement.
The race is underway. Susan Ladd is a reporter for the Greensboro News and Record. Thank you for being on the program. There's more just ahead on the state of things. Stay with us for an investigative report from Greensboro. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the Upstage Cabaret at Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stacio, and there's a lot of news today coming out of the Triad. We turn now to an investigative report, an investigation into the backlog of food stamp applications in Guilford County. And it reveals that someone told employees to hide thousands of pending applications from the federal government. Kelly Poe is a reporter with the Greensboro News and Record. She wrote the piece in the Greensboro News and Record about the backlog, and she joins us today on the State of Things. Welcome back, Kelly.
Thank you for having me.
So give us some background on this. How did this whole story get started?
Well, in late March, it came to light that there was this backlog of unprocessed food stamps applications. At its height, it was about 8,100 applications. Those were recertification cases, so those were people who had been receiving SNAP benefits, and then they reapplied, and they weren't getting processed. At the time, the director of the department, Robert Williams, told reporters, and I covered it at the time, told us that it was a technical problem, that these cases were getting put into one computer system but not NCFAST, which is the state computer system, which would have generated the reports that would have been sent to the state and to the U.S. Department of Agriculture to tell us how many cases we had. At stake here was that if the counties didn't meet this deadline of March 31st to clear their backlogs, the state could have lost $88 million from the USDA that would have been sent to administrative costs of the food stamp program.
So we've got three levels of government, right? We've got federal, state, and local government, county government. A backlog, it's got to be cleared, high stakes. And then at some point, we realized that this backlog has been covered up. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So after this backlog came to light, Director Robert Williams resigned. And since then, the county board, the DSS board, they had actually just received a report about a week earlier that showed that they were caught up on the backlog. They had been told that we were all caught up on the backlog. And so after Williams resigned, after they took care of clearing the backlog, which was a very expensive process, by the way, but after they took care of clearing the backlog, the DSS board launched an internal investigation. And that was never made public. That was presented to the DSS board at a closed session. And I recently got a public records request that I had put in place about 5 weeks earlier for the report from the investigation that showed that at least some of the staff, and we don't know how many, but at least some of the staff had been instructed not to enter the cases into NCFAST. It wasn't that they didn't know how, it was that they were instructed not to, because if they did, the USDA would find out about the backlog.
So keep it out of the state system so the feds don't find out. Somebody, and do we know who it was who gave that instruction to the employees at the county level?
We do not. I am working on finding that information.
It was redacted in the report, right? So it's in there. So somebody knows.
Someone knows.
And, I mean, this is interesting to me that the DSS at the county level can commission a report to find out about what is ultimately malfeasance or perhaps something that needs correction at the very least. And this wouldn't be public knowledge unless you had filed for a Freedom of Information request. I mean, so you had to do that.
That's true. I made the request.
It would not have been made public. There was no sort of track for this to be made public at a meeting or something.
There was certainly no press release.
All right. So where are we now, and what's happening now that it has been released to the press and now the public? What's going on with the story?
Well, the Department of Social Services has a new – well, I'm saying the Department of Social Services. The Department of Social Services actually does not exist anymore. Because the county commissioners have since combined it with the Department of Health. However, the social services operations have a new interim director, and that director had nothing to do with the backlog. And the director at the time of the backlog, now, I mean, I don't mean to implicate him. We have no reason to believe he was the one who sent out the order not to enter into NCFAST, but he was the director at the time. He did have oversight, and he has already resigned. So.
Do we know the extent now of the backlog? What is it, according to this report? How many people are not getting food stamps who should?
The backlog has been cleared. There is a very small percentage of unprocessed cases now, but it's in line. There is, however, and I have a story coming out about this tomorrow, a backlog of unprocessed Medicaid applications. But they're certainly not hiding it.
Not this time. We will. Well, thank you very much. And part of this, I guess, has to do with NCFAST, too, because there was a problem with that system. That's the state system. Did that play a role in any of this?
It sure did. Guilford County was one of the original pilot counties to get the NCFAST system, and it was also one of the largest counties. And it has had NCFAST had a lot of technical problems. And Guilford County had been behind on their food stamps backlog since May 2012 when they first got it. The big issue, from my understanding, was that after a caseworker would input a case into NCFAST, it was very hard later for them to find that same case to process it.
All right. Well, Kelly Poe, thank you for your reporting so far. We look forward to your piece in the Greensboro News and Record tomorrow on Medicaid. Thanks for being with us. Kelly Poe, reporter for the Greensboro News and Record.